At Market District, we believe in the power of great taste. So here's a little taste of all the delicious possibilities. Juicy, hand-picked heirloom tomatoes. Seared certified Angus steak over aged cheddar mashed potatoes. Or how about fresh dough stretched by hand for every house-made pizza? Is your mouth watering yet? From produce to meats to chef-made meals, discover great taste at Market District.
With temps in the 40s and 50s this weekend, it's hard not to get out around town. Hopefully you found a way to get out and enjoy some warmer weather. I'm Katie O'Connell, and you're listening to Behind the Headlines from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Thanks so much for tuning in. In today's show, editor Chris Foran has some insight into this year's Academy Awards, including the Oscars So White controversy. And columnist Christian Snyder tells us about his background and how it informs his work. In news, Madison Train's sociologist Matthew Desmond is releasing a new book, compiling his years of research about evictions. His book, titled Evicted: Poverty and Profit in the American City, draws largely on his experiences renting in Milwaukee and studying evictions here. Desmond currently teaches at Harvard University and received a MacArthur Genius Grant last year. Journal Sentinel reporter John Smid interviewed Desmond about his new book. He talks with Ashley Lutheran about that interview and what he learned from Desmond's research.
So, John, why did Matthew Desmond choose Milwaukee for his urban laboratory, as you put it?
Yeah, I think that it was a pretty natural choice for a guy who is based, who was doing his undergraduate work in Madison at the University of Wisconsin. They had some really nice resources like the University of Wisconsin Survey Center, which came in really handy for Desmond's data work. But I think just as compelling, or even more so, is that Milwaukee itself is a natural choice if you are a urban social scientist. This is a city that is really hard hit. It's always consistently got some of the highest poverty levels in the nation. I even recall after Hurricane Katrina, there was a lot of comparisons made between Milwaukee and the lower Ninth Ward in New Orleans. So it gave Matt Desmond a lot of material to work with.
Which of his findings were most surprising to you?
The one that is kind of like the headline number that came out of Matt's research was that in the years that they did the survey, it's rather shocking, actually. 1 in 8 Milwaukee renters were forcibly removed from their homes, either through a formal eviction, the kind where you have a sheriff at your door, an informal eviction where the landlord has all sorts of ways to pressure you out, or a building condemnation. And so 1 in 8, that's huge. That got a lot of people's interested in what's going on here. Mothers and children as renters are hardest hit. It's a bit heart-wrenching. Looking at urban Milwaukee, Desmond notes statistically that black men have a disproportionately high incarceration rate. It's a sad but true aspect of Milwaukee. So as he puts it, black men are locked in, black women are locked out.
You talk a lot about the data presented within Matt's book. Were there any individuals or families who stuck with you after you were done reading it, characters who are, in this case, real people who you just couldn't stop thinking about?
Yeah, there was. There was. Just so folks know, what Matt Desmond did was really interesting. He embedded himself for a long time in a predominantly white trailer park in a predominantly white part of the South Side, and then rented and moved to the North Side in a predominantly black neighborhood. So he follows 8 people around and tells their narratives quite intimately. The one that stuck with me most is, and some of these were re-evicted over time, it's really strong material, is a guy named Scott who lived in that trailer park. I don't want to reduce his life to 3 sentences, but here we go. Started off as a male nurse in a hospital. Had a stable, almost middle-class existence living in one of the nice neighborhoods. Threw out his back or injured himself, got onto some kind of painkiller that's wickedly addictive. That started a downward spiral in this young man's life. He ended up in the trailer park, gets evicted from the trailer park, is moving around a lot, is living with total instability and a drug problem. interestingly, and Desmond makes this point, it wasn't until he got a lucky break, got a subsidized apartment, finally some rental stability, a place to call home, that he was able to turn the drug habit around, get some employment. So it took a housing to find some stability in this man's life.
And how could this research shift or affect public policy here in Milwaukee?
Desmond does dwell on a lot of those points. And the one that stuck out with me is that you've got this thing called eviction court. It's extremely busy in Milwaukee, as you've probably intuited by now. In eviction court, low-income families have no right to counsel. It doesn't come automatically. But if tenants are given lawyers, their chances of keeping their home increase dramatically, Desmond finds. So one of the policy prescriptions he makes would be to find some way of funding some legal services for low-income families.
Given that context looking ahead, it's probably useful to take a quick look back as well. How have evictions changed over time? What are they like now?
He looks at all this historical documentation to see if evictions were always so commonplace and so ordinary and so frequent, and that's not the case. Over the past century, even in big cities, even in big poor cities, an eviction was so rare that it used to draw crowds that would come out and protest. How can you throw this guy out on the street? Or that it was just such a rarity that they would come out and see, oh, God, there's a guy thrown out on the street. Now, of course, that's changed. Now it's just part of the urban fabric.
Read John's story in the Journal Sentinel and at jsonline.com. The 88th Annual Academy Awards airs at 7:30 p.m. Sunday on ABC. The Leonardo DiCaprio starring survival tale, The Revenant, is leading the pack with 12 nominations. But it's the controversy over the lack of diversity in the acting categories that has been dominating the discussion. For the second year in a row, all 20 actors up for Oscars are white, triggering an ongoing debate dubbed #OscarSoWhite. It started on social media immediately after the nominations were announced. Journal Sentinel reporter Piet Levy asked features editor Chris Forn about the impact Oscar So White might have on this year's award and what categories viewers should keep a close eye on.
Chris Forn, welcome to Behind the Headlines.
Thank you.
So the Oscars, very exciting, or maybe it's not so exciting. It seems there's been a lot of discussion about Oscar So White, a lot of controversy around this. Right. In what way do you think that's really going to impact the show, especially with Chris Rock as the host?
Well, I think it'll define the show. Chris Rock was picked to be the host of the show long before the nominations came out, and it's by accident that it works out so well. I mean, he's not going to shy away from the topic, obviously. Nobody probably would, but it'll be front and center because it is front and center. It's a major issue in Hollywood. It's a major issue in entertainment, the disproportionate role that minorities are given the opportunity to play in what's on the screen and what's behind the camera. So he'll kick it around, but he'll do it in a way that's smart and funny and intelligent like he always does. So that you probably could not have picked a better person to host the show this year.
Besides him, though, what are some other things to kind of keep an eye on? It seems like The Revenant is leading the pack. Do you think they're going to, that film will run away with everything?
Well, if you believe the odds makers and some of the Hollywood insider groups, it looks like The Revenant will be the picture to beat for Best Picture. It's also the only one of the few sure thing nomination categories is probably Leonardo DiCaprio winning Best Actor for the movie, and the director Alejandro González Iñárritu is likely to win for Best Director, unless he doesn't. In past years, picture and director went side by side. They don't always do that anymore. The Producers Guild, which is often seen as a predictor for the Best Picture winner, picked The Big Short this year, so that could go that way. Spotlight won Best Cast, which is sort of the acting version of Best Picture at the Screen Actors Guild. Some people think it's got a shot, but I would think that The Revenant seems to be the kind of movie that Hollywood likes to have as a Best Picture. So,
if Iñárritu wins, that'll be kind of a rare occurrence.
Right.
At the Oscars, right? It's pretty rare the directors win back to back.
Right. The last time that happened was 1950, when Joseph Mankiewicz won for All About Eve after winning for A Letter to Three Wives the year before. I guess it's even rarer that if it wins Best Picture, that a director had back-to-back movies that won Best Picture. That doesn't happen, hasn't happened ever, I don't think. So that's kind of a big deal.
Wow.
If you're into that sort of thing.
Sure, sure. DiCaprio seems like a lock, especially since he's been nominated so many times and just hasn't won. Any other categories to kind of keep an eye on that are of particular interest to you or you think will be to viewers?
The Oscars are sort of like the Super Bowl. People don't really root for a close race. They root for their team. And so it depends on who you really like. It seems like Brie Larson, who plays the mother in Room, is the other real big lock for Best Actress. The category where we have two Wisconsin people running against each other, Best Supporting Actor, it's likely that Mark Ruffalo and Mark Rylance will both lose to Sylvester Stallone, who is seen as another likely winner, sort of a career achievement award plus, you know, Survivor, and the fact that he was nominated for the same part 39 years before, I guess people are excited about.
Yeah, that's interesting that you've got two Wisconsin natives battling it out for the gold. Has that ever happened before?
It happened once that I could figure out, and that was back in the early 30s when Frederick March won for Best Actor, actually tied with Wallace Beery over Ten Chimney's own Alfred Lunt, who was the only time he was ever nominated for The Guardsman, and he was they only had three people nominated in the category, and he was the only one to lose. It's kind of a tough one to take. The only other Wisconsin person of note who's actually nominated, there are a lot of people who worked on some of the movies that are nominated, but the only other one is Adam Stockhausen, who's nominated for Best Production Design for Bridge of Spies. A terrific movie, but he's not likely to win. He won last year for The Grand Budapest Hotel. So this is his third year running being nominated, which in itself is an accomplishment.
If you're looking for more predictions this year, you can find them online at tapmilwaukee.com. We also have ballots you can print in case you'd like to cast yours. The last quarter of 2015 was a tough one at Orion Energy Systems of Manitowoc. The manufacturer of LED lighting saw sales decline. Revenue was nearly $10 million below what analysts expected. As a result, many investors sold their Orion Energy stock. So is more trouble ahead for the company? Journal Sentinel reporter Tom Content talks with Bob Friday about Orion's future.
Tom, what made you decide to do this story?
I've been covering Orion Energy for a while, and it's been interesting to watch them trying to transform the company after the changeover in the CEO a couple of years ago. But the most recent earnings report, they've typically report losses, but this time they reported a lot less, lot lower sales than the analysts had expected, and the stock market just punished them the next day, and it just stayed down there even into the following weeks. So I wanted to just come back and look at that a little more.
You know, so often we see that a company has a bad quarter and stockholders dump their shares. That appears to have happened in this case. Why is that?
The company says the analysts were a little bit too optimistic about how the quarter would go because the company had some unusually strong orders the same quarter the prior year. And right now with the stock market has been as volatile as it is and concerns about the economy, investors aren't wasting any time to leave companies behind if they have a big miss.
When investors do this, a sell-off like this, does it have any major effect on a company's day-to-day operations or decisions?
Well, it can if they have a lot of debt. It could, in some cases, make them vulnerable to a takeover or something because their value is a lot lower. But companies that don't carry a lot of debt can still make a go of it as long as they have enough cash coming in and cash on hand. That's always a challenge.
So in this case, does Orion have a lot of debt, and do you see it as being in any significant long-term trouble?
Well, the analyst I talked to, one of the analysts I talked to, noted that they don't carry a lot of debt, and that they have a strategy, and it's going to be lumpy. I guess is the way that the way the orders come in.
Why did this happen in energy saving? What happened with complex fluorescent technology that made it less desirable, and now LED is like king of the mountain?
Yeah, it's amazing. The technological advances of LED are are, I guess, folks in the industry aren't shocked, but the statistics are interesting. The geeks use the word lumens per watt, which is kind of, if you think about your car and your MPG that you get, for the lighting folks, it's lumens per watt. And the lumens per watt on LED are just so much higher.
Now, forget about Orion for a moment. You've written about energy and the energy industry, saving energy for years. So these days, if our listeners want to replace a light bulb in their home, should they buy a conventional incandescent bulb if they can find one, a compact fluorescent bulb, or an LED bulb?
It's all kind of what the people like to use is, you know, what's it going to cost over time? The LED is going to cost a lot for a bulb, but those prices are coming down. You can get deals. I just snagged a 4-pack for that didn't set me back too much. And if you look at your energy bills over time, you're going to see savings, especially if you use what the Focus on Energy and others who focus on energy efficiency talk about is you replace the most used light bulbs with either fluorescent or LED. Because the incandescent is basically a lot of the energy that in an incandescent bulb is. It was great at the time in Thomas Edison's day, but it's a lot of it is just generating heat instead of light. And the difference now with these new technologies is that they're generating, especially LED, it's light without heat. And so you're getting a lot of savings that way over time.
Tom's story is in today's Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. It's also online at jsonline.com/business. Columnist Christian Snyder comes at his work from a different perspective than others. Rather than getting his start in journalism, Christian started off working in politics. And if you read his work, you can tell he approaches things a little bit differently. Here's editorial editor David Haynes talking to Christian.
So this is David Haynes. I'm the opinions editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And I'm chatting today with Christian Snyder, who is a columnist for the editorial page. Chris, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You bet. So I thought we'd talk a bit today about your background, because I think your background is a little bit different than some of the rest of us who are in journalism, but I think it really informs what you do. You worked in the legislature for a while, correct?
Indeed I did, yes, for 8 years.
For 8 years. And what did you do?
I was primarily like a legislative assistant. I clerked a committee. I wrote laws, stuff like that. Dealt a little bit with constituents, but it was never my favorite thing to do. So, mostly just drafting up legislation, trying to get it through the process and get it passed. That's pretty much it.
And you worked for Sheila Harsdorf, is that correct?
Yes, she's a state senator, a longtime state senator now from the northwest part of the state, kind of the River Falls, Hudson area.
Right, a Republican. And what did you learn from that experience, and how does that inform what you do now?
Well, a lot, actually. As I'm sure probably a lot of listeners know, as I was working in the legislature, I was actually kind of writing a blog under an assumed name that I thought—
I remember that.
At the time was kind of my way of trying to explain to people kind of what was really going on in the Capitol. Not really gossipy, but saying here are some things that you know we're thinking about here, you know, working in the legislature that other people should know. And you know, it was an attempt to try to be funny sometimes too. But so I worked on that for a little while, but for the most part, in terms of writing. First of all, it helps to know where to look for stuff. You know, you can go to the Legislative Reference Bureau, Legislative Fiscal Bureau. These are all departments that help the legislature with information that they need to pass bills. So I kind of know where to go there to find the same documents that the legislature is using. So when I write, I can kind of use the same information that they're using, which is really helpful.
Well, I think also, sometimes you bring I've seen this in your writing, you bring a perspective of having been there,
right.
You know, watching the sausage get made and, you know, having this perspective that, you know, hey, we think this maybe is the first time this has ever happened. Well, you know, this happens a lot. This is part of the process. I've seen you sort of bring that perspective before to your writing.
Right. That is true. I guess I do have some experience with, you know, when this thing happened in 2003, I was there for that. And, you know, history kind of repeats itself. I mean, it's interesting in that there always seems to be more to the story. I mean, for us in journalism, you know, we have a couple hundred words to explain something, but there always seems to be something more when you're working in the legislature. And, you know, one of the first things that I actually wrote when I was doing my blog was kind of an explanation of the Taxpayer Bill of Rights. I don't know if you remember that.
Tabor, you bet.
Yes, it was the big constitutional amendment that people wanted to – Republicans, conservatives wanted to they knew Jim Doyle wasn't going to sign their property tax freeze, and so they thought they'd go around and do a constitutional amendment to be voted on by taxpayers. I didn't think it was all that great of an idea, mostly because I kind of knew all these pools of money, where they were, how they worked, how they interacted with each other. So that was really one of the first things that I wrote about, was to just try to explain to people, like, you know, this may not be the best idea. And, you know, we lost a Senate majority leader over it because Mary Panzer wouldn't pass it.
That's
and,
right.
And they kicked her out of office. So that was kind of a big deal. So, yeah, I mean, there's always more to the story. I mean, you know, people say, well, let's change the school financing formula. Well, I mean, it's super complicated. There are so many moving parts. You know, Madison's always saying, well, we need more money for the Madison School District, even though it's one of the richest school districts in the state. So where are you going to start taking money from to give to Madison? I mean, there's just so many moving parts. And so I think being part of that process and learning kind of how it all fits together was really, you know, exciting and illuminating.
Yep. And helped make your column what it is now. So, Chris, thanks so much. We appreciate your time. Chris Christian Schneider, who's based in Madison, but writes a column for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's editorial page. And I'm David Haynes.
If you'd like to read some of Christian's work, he's got a column in today's editorial section. You can also find his work at jsonline.com/opinion. And you can follow Christian on Twitter at Schneider_CM. That's Schneider_CM. Could Donald Trump win over some Democrats? That may seem impossible, but it could happen. Washington Bureau Chief Craig Gilbert gave his analysis of what the general election race might look like during this week's JS on Politics show. Here's his chat once again with editorial editor David Haynes.
We're joined now by Craig Gilbert of our Washington Bureau. And Craig, I believe you're working on a piece that is looking at Donald Trump's support potentially with the other side. Talk about what you're finding.
Well, you know, the closer Donald Trump, every step he takes toward the Republican nomination, this discussion and debate about his electability will grow. There's a lot of skepticism about his ability to win a general election. His counter to that is that he'll build on his white working class base in the Republican Party and be able to draw blue collar Democrats in a way that makes him more electable than other potential Republicans. It's interesting, if you look at that in the polling now, there's not a lot of evidence that that's happening. You have to take these early general election polls with a huge grain of salt. But right now, Donald Trump is not pulling Democrats, crossover Democrats in, to any greater degree than Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio. And in fact, he's actually losing more Republicans than those other candidates.
So, Craig, yeah, I was going to ask you about the polls, but it's still pretty early, right?
It's really early. And we've already seen, you know, one example of how the early polls can be wrong. For a long time, the polling was showing on the Republican side that Trump has these huge negatives and that's a huge percentage of Republican voters that would not support him under any circumstances, that he had this sort of low ceiling that was going to hold him back as the field winnowed, but the field has shrunk and Donald Trump is still building his support among Republican voters. So he kind of proved the doubters wrong so far on that front. It's a bigger, you know, it's a tougher question for him in the general election on electability, because this is a very polarized country. And so he's arguing that he can break through that polarization and draw support from crossover Democrats, especially blue-collar Democrats, and particularly in states like Wisconsin and Michigan and Ohio, states in the Midwest that have been battleground states that have been hard in some cases for Republicans to win. Again, we're not seeing that in the polling yet, but this is a really important trend and pattern to watch going forward if, in fact, Donald Trump keeps marching toward the Republican nomination. There's going to be a lot of concern within the Republican Party about his electability. So this is a key thing to watch.
So there is an example, though, in history, right? Everyone wants to compare themselves to Ronald Reagan. Well, Ronald Reagan actually did that.
Ronald Reagan did do that. Again, it's a different world now because people are much more hardened in their voting along party lines, and so it's tougher to do that. And just because you can win blue-collar white voters and are strong with them in the Republican Party, it doesn't mean you're necessarily going to draw blue-collar white Democrats. And that's really the test that would face Donald Trump, because he could actually lose some support among college-educated Republicans. I mean, there are people you meet out on the campaign trail who just don't like his style and are kind of appalled and horrified by him. And so, you know, whatever Republican support he loses, he's got to more than make up for on the Democratic side.
But there is within the Democratic Party a strain, as there is in the Republican Party, of working class angst, right? So that could argue that there's at least a chance there for somebody like Trump to pull in those voters.
Yeah, I mean, that definitely has existed, and that's clearly something that Bernie Sanders has been tapping into. But whether the same voters that are driven toward Bernie Sanders because of their worries about the economy and their own economic situation, whether they would be similarly drawn to Donald Trump is a big, big question.
Well, and there's also, isn't there the question of Donald Trump needing to pivot? I mean, I would think that's a pretty big pivot for Donald Trump at this point.
It is, and this is another thing to watch, because Donald Trump has been a very flexible guy. You know, we've talked about how his appeal in some ways is not very ideological, and he's even signaled, he's not very subtle about this. I mean, he's said that his style and his demeanor would be different as president and possibly as a general election nominee, and whether he could pivot on substance on some of these issues, he's already pivoted. I mean, he's already taking positions that are kind of anathema to some very hardline conservative activists. And so, you know, you could argue that gives him a little bit more potential than the average Republican nominee, because he's talking about not cutting entitlements, because he's talking about, you know, negotiating drug prices with the government, negotiating drug prices, because he's taking positions that are not kind of, that are kind of heresy among
Planned Parenthood.
Republicans. Yeah, saying nice things about Planned Parenthood. These are all things that could actually, you know, give him some appeal to conservative and moderate Democrats.
Yeah. And we as voters have short attention spans, as we well know. So with that in mind, Craig, thanks so much for your time.
Great talking with you.
A full replay of JS on Politics is available at jsonline.com. If you're curious about that show, you can also find it as a podcast on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. That's it for today's show. If you're interested in some of the other podcasts produced by the Journal Sentinel, you can find them in iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or online at jsonline.com/politics. Thanks so much for listening, and join me next week as I take you behind the headlines in our newsroom.
At Market District, we believe in the power of great taste, like juicy heirloom tomatoes, cheesy house-made pizza, and fresh artisan-made bread. From produce to meats to chef-made meals, discover great taste at Market District.